This is the Tom Bigby Tales, and I'm your host, Shannon Evans, and I write about a small town in Northeast Mississippi on the Tom Bigby River called Columbus. And sometimes I write about the rest of the state. Today, I'm writing about Lucy's Journal, something I found in the reserves at the Columbus Local Library. Unfortunately, it's no longer in print, but it's a fascinating examination into the lives of a young woman who was about between the ages of 18 and 22 at the beginning of the Civil War. Lucy's journal is from 1860 to 1865, and it's a fascinating examination of this time. So I'm going to tell you a little bit more about this book because I think it's a fascinating read, and I think it tells us a lot about how life in the Civil War in Columbus was really a lot of parties and activities for the locals. Some things never change in Columbus. I recently came across a journal at the library from a young woman from Columbus, specifically a little outside of Columbus on the Lux Flala Banks, who was between 18 and 22 years of age during the Civil War. The journal starts in 1860 with Lucy Irion attending boarding school at the Female Institute in Corinth. She had attended the Columbus Female Institute, but her family's financial situation sent her to Corinth, where a wealthier family member underwrote the completion of her education. Under the rumbling winds of war and the whispers of secession, Lucy graduates as valedictorian of her class. She returns home to Columbus and settles into the life of a society girl, attending parties, picnics, church events, plays, and weddings in Columbus, a life typical of an unmarried young woman of means. Eliza Lucy Irion was born March 3rd, 1843, near Bolivar, Tennessee. Her mother, Lucinda Gray Irion, died when Lucy was 3 years old. Her family moved to Lowndes County, Mississippi from Tennessee to be near her paternal aunts, Elizabeth Holderness and Catherine Hayden. The entire family, except brother John Lewis Irion, settled into their new home, Woodlawn, on the Lexapalila Banks, just outside of Columbus, Mississippi. Brother John had already moved to Texas. In the 1860 census, John is living in Montgomery, Texas, married and a physician. He will go on to serve as the assistant surgeon of the 20th Texas Infantry in the Civil War. The family would remain at Woodlawn before eventually moving into nearby Willow Cottage. Lucy attended the Columbus Female Institute from 1855 to 1858, where she would board with various locals. She then transferred to Corona College in Corinth, where she spent those last 2 years and graduated in 1860. By January of 1861, Lucy is busily engaged visiting relatives in town. Lincoln had just won the 1860 presidential election. South Carolina seceded from the Union in December of 1860, and Mississippi seceded January 9, 1861, and Florida on January 10th. Lincoln was inaugurated March the 4th, and the war was declared when the April shots are ordered fired upon Fort Sumter by Stephen D. Lee, who would later marry a local Columbus girl. The idea of war in Columbus was treated initially like a grand party. Lucy's brother Jim joined the Columbus Riflemen and began marching and drilling with the other men, training to fight for their cause. Lucy's writing embraces the idealism of the people so far from the war's front. The men were absorbed with war, and the women equally so. All social affairs are neglected, and jeweled fingers are busy knitting for soldiers. Sewing societies are organized, and every spare moment spent working for the soldiers. But then she's right back to picnics with her siblings and swimming lessons in the Lux Flala by her brother. However, Jim is sent off to train eventually in Kentucky for battle before being sent to be a quartermaster and thankfully away from harm's way and actual battles. Christmas of 1861, according to her journal passes with a wedding. 1862 began with the fall of Fort Donelson in Tennessee, and most of the Columbus riflemen are taken prisoner or fell in battle. As the Battle of Shiloh rages near family in Corinth, a tiny family member succumbs at Lucy's home to the measles. The grief-stricken family is in mourning when the trains and wagons of wounded men are brought to Columbus from Shiloh, so her family doesn't participate in nursing the ill and the injured. However, the married and single older women of town nurse the injured, and the young girls and single ladies stayed home making clothes, rolling bandages, and knitting socks for the injured, per Lucy's journal. As Corinth was bound to be next on the list of invasions by the Yankees, family members there evacuated to Columbus, and Corona College was made headquarters to the officers of the Union and also a Yankee hospital. All the evacuated cousins and the nearby encampment of the 36th Regiment made for a gay summer and fall for Lucy and her house guests. Their parlor, veranda, and gallery filled with dashing young Confederate officers and pretty girls, and cake and strawberries apparently were plentiful, despite the Yankees having taken Corinth, Memphis, Friars Point, and Helena, Arkansas. A cousin, Barron, was taken prisoner in Corinth by the Yankees. However, he was on parole and was quite ill, but still had, according to his letters home to Lucy's family in Columbus, quote, at least half his enslaved people working his land and others hired out at other places. And yet, tea parties still were the rage, and Lucy and other upper gentry class Columbus citizens were continuing to party on despite the war and all the losses. Every now and then, Lucy writes of twinges of guilt about their frivolity, usually after the news of a massive loss by the Southern troops. Her brother McKinney is injured on Cannon Hill by a small piece of cannon shrapnel in Corinth. It turns septic and he dies in 10 days. Suddenly, the war is brought home to Lucy and her family, and her brother is laid to rest at Friendship Cemetery in Plot 59. Her brother Jim gets exempted and sent home from war so he can run the family's farm in the prairie. Now the news of death after death of family members at war rolls in during the fall of 1862. But 1863 is filled with more loss. However, it's local and at home, and the normal type of loss that they were used to from colds, flu, pneumonia, due to the lack of antibiotics that anyone had in that time. Cousin Parthenia died of pneumonia in February, followed by a beloved uncle of the same affliction in May. The girls were all sick and weak from the winter, so Lucy's older sister-in-law, Hattie, decided they should all go to Georgia and then up to Mount Vale Springs to spa in Tennessee and take the cure. All was happy and gay for 6 weeks while visiting in Athens, Georgia. As the family left to go to Mount Vale, Knoxville fell, and the group of women returned to Athens, Georgia, disappointed. As they pulled back in to Athens, news came that Vicksburg had fallen. Hattie, worried she'd be cut off from home by the enemy, left Lucy and Hattie's daughter Bessie in Georgia. She then jumps on a train with her maid Lizzie and Henry Hillier, the son of their Georgia host, and heads for home. Lucy's brother Jim is furious when he finds out Lucy is left in Georgia with their niece. He was afraid they too would be cut off and isolated in Georgia without any family nearby. So he went to fetch them. They all rode home on the train with Governor Whitfield, a Columbus friend. Whitfield was the owner of Snowden. With the fall of Vicksburg, the Corinth and Tennessee cousins left for Florida. Her sister-in-law, Hattie, the one who left her in Georgia, now decided she was starved for their former luxuries, so she went with a friend shopping in Yankee-occupied Memphis and returns with a wagon full of goodies. Always a good time, girl Hattie. Columbus in 1863 was the capital, as Jackson was now in enemy hands. The legislature was in session here, as was the Methodist Conference. Legislators and preachers held court in the finest parlors in town. Several large parties were given until the legislature adjourned in December of 1863. More party life for Lucy and the ladies of Columbus. On January 25th of 1864, at the height of the Civil War, in the midst of all, the Yankees burned Corona College in Corinth. Lucy was sad, but her sister-in-law Hattie was bored and determined that they would travel to Demopolis, Alabama, with Sister Cordell, and so they needed the appropriate winter wardrobe, which kept all the women busy sewing and designing and having a grand time, spending all this money on these luxurious winter travel clothes. Then news is brought that family in Gainesville are cut off by the Yankees and need rescuing in February. So brother Jim gets the much treasured mules and wagons and buggies and runs off to Gainesville to rescue their family and bring them back. By early March, they are all planning a wedding for their sister, Lizzie, to cousin Baron. Baron, the newlywed, will be dead before he's married a month from pneumonia. But no time to mourn too long, because Sister Hattie is having a late fall wedding and getting remarried and spends $1,000 each for two dresses, $800 for two others, and $325 for a bonnet, all in the midst of the Civil War. Fancy teas and a wedding supper with dancing will follow the ceremony. In January of 1865, brought more weddings. In the midst of losing the war, Columbus folks sure knew how to party. They didn't let a little old thing like death and dying in a civil war stop a good party. One wedding at St. Paul's was for Lieutenant General Stephen D. Lee. Yes, Stephen D. Lee of Charleston fame and the beginning of the Civil War, to Miss Regina Harrison of Columbus. It was a high military affair with eight couples as attendants, and it was standing room only. Elegant party after elegant soiree is described for January, February, and March of 1865. Social gatherings, church events, nights of parlor games, and the midst of it all, according to Lucy, here comes the Yankees making a raid on Columbus, necessitating sending their enslaved people, their mules, and all their silver and jewelry into the swamp. This is about all that she speaks about in the war, during the war era, and what happens to the people who work for them that are enslaved or their property. Nowhere is there any pressing need for caution, or are they concerned about losing the war. It's very telling. And this is late in the spring of 1865. Once again, their family's land is filled with encamped Confederates in March of 1865, and their table and parlor are again filled with their beloved boys, the young Confederate officers. But April 9th, 1865, news begins to trickle in of defeat. General Robert E. Lee has surrendered with honor at Appomattox Courthouse, surrounded by the Union troops. The war was over. The men began to return to home, and according to Lucy, were humiliated and degraded. Although God knows they have done their duty, per Lucy. New goods are brought to town, but no one has money to buy anything. And Lucy proclaims, quote, "Negroes are flocking to their liberators and the foundations of society are broken." That is all she says about the liberation of the enslaved people of her community. The gaiety and lighthearted live and let live of Lucy and her friends and family have ended. The reality of a new era under Reconstruction martial law looms. The grand party has ended. What awaits her is an uncertain future and few prospects on the horizon. to read an excerpt from her book that is the last paragraph. It's very telling. God forgive us the bitter feelings we have in our hearts toward the enemy. But oh, our land is a pleasant ye land. Yea, tis a goodly heritage. Tis ours by right of birth and every other right under heaven. Yet they wish to drive us out like outcasts. God help us to stand by our birthright. The future seems dark. Our strong men shake their heads in doubt because they know how grasping the Yankees are and what lack of mercy they can show. But all unnecessary doubts and fear are sinful. We must cast our burdens upon the Lord, and He will sustain us. We, as a family, have determined to bear all with fortitude and leave the future to God. Therefore, although all is dark, we, as a family, are lively and cheerful. Ever since the surrender, 5 May 1865, we have had our cottage filled with company and laughter. Wild and free has flowed as in the piping time of 1860. So even in surrender, Columbus folks are still partying. Hopefully, the next book in my series, A New Southern Woman, the correspondence of the same woman, Eliza Lucy Arian Nielsen from 1871 to 1883, will answer some of the questions about that uncertain future that Lucy faced. And did they still party on, dude, as she seemed to be embracing with the rest of Columbus in her journal from 1860 to 1865? I want to thank you for coming on my podcast, and I hope you learned something more about the people of Columbus and the lives they lived in this series about women in Columbus. Until next time.